Hi, I'm Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and thanks for being with us today. I'm thrilled today to have Dr. Bruce Lipton with us to talk about methylation. If anybody knows about methylation, it's going to be him, and I'm just so thrilled to have him. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Lipton.
And okay. Your wonderful audience, the audience of the cultural creatives out there that are helping us evolve into a thrivable future, so I so appreciate them as well.
Absolutely. Now, before we get started, I just want to say that Dr. Lipton is not attempting to treat or diagnose anyone, that the information contained on this program today is simply that, information. Please go and defer to your personal care practitioner for any help that you need. So, do you want to give us your website and where people can get your books before we get started on this?
Okay, well, just if this topic is of interest, and as well as any of the associated things we talk about, my website is simply brucelipton.com. And there's lots of articles and things to download there, resource page to find things to help us move into that future that we would love to see. And so it's a good source of information.
So, all this talk that's going on in the world, because this seems to be probably one of the hottest topics in the world right now, is this big word called methylation. Can you give us a brief description of what that thing is before we go into it?
Yeah, let's just start with the whole concept of genetics and the genetics that we've been programmed with versus the new genetics that really undermines the basic thinking that we thought was sound science now is not necessarily true, and there's a new science. So let's start off with first. When I was teaching back in medical school back in the 70s and 80s, we were teaching a concept called genetic determinism. And that's a belief that genes control the characteristics, not just of our physical biology, but of our behavior and our emotions, so that they were looking for genes to control this behavior or genes to control that emotion, with the belief, and this is the issue, the belief that genes were self-actualizing. What I mean by that is the common phrase that almost everybody hears is, oh, a gene turned on and a gene turned off. It's like, okay, that's a nice idea, but what does that mean? You mean a gene makes a decision? A gene says, listen, we're going to do this, and a gene, or we're going to do that? And this is what we bought into, and that's where the concept, oh, well, when I then talk about your fate, I say, you know what? At the moment of conception, the genes that ended up in your fertilized egg, those genes are like a pattern of your life plan, because the genes control just the physical characteristics, things that we believe such as cancer and Alzheimer's, diabetes, all these things that we were saying, oh, these are gene-related, so that if you inherited these genes that were defective, inevitably you would expect to experience it. So if there's cancer in your family, you go, oh, my God, I've connected with these genes that I could get this cancer as well. And, of course, the biggest problem with this teaching is that it really comes down to this. It says, A, as far as we know, you didn't pick the genes you came with. B, you cannot change the genes if you don't like the characteristics. Those are your genes. And C, they control you. You don't control them. And all of a sudden, I say, what did we train people? What belief did people walk away with? And the answer is, I'm a victim. I'm a victim of my heredity. My genes made me do this. The genes are causing my illness. The genes are, the source of whatever problems that I face in my life. And I cannot change these genes, and therefore I'm a victim of this genetic activity. And see, the insidious thing about making you a victim is that the moment you feel, well, I'm powerless over these genes, who can help me? Who's the rescuer? And all of a sudden, why that becomes important is because the more you feel in fear and being powerless over controlling your life, the more you will spend to pay somebody to take care of your life. And so we bought into this issue, and that's why today we have this massive healthcare crisis where there's so much illness on this planet, and the medical profession has gotten bigger and bigger and more costly. So not only is there a crisis of people getting sick, but there's an economic crisis to try to bring people back to health again, all from what? A belief of being powerless, a belief that genes are making your life, and we must, in, by all means, try the chemistry, the pharmaceutical approach to control those genes. And that will give us some sense of power over our lives. So I say, yeah, this is a concept called genetic determinism. And when people say the word genetic control, they're saying control by genes. And that involves self-actualization. So now let's put the biggest false statement in the world into perspective. The false statement is genes turn on and genes turn off. And why is it false? And the answer is simply a gene is a blueprint. It is a molecular blueprint, nothing more than that. It is a pattern used to make the proteins, which are the building blocks of the body. So it's like a repository of blueprints. The nucleus has all these genes, and there are blueprints to make this protein or that protein, to make the skin proteins versus the brain proteins, as we have all these different genes to make these proteins. And the significance is this is the absolute truth. The gene is a linear blueprint to create the molecules that form a protein, which is like a beaded chain. I go, why? What is the relevance of that statement? And it comes down simply to this, Eva, that is that that when we talk about genes and we say they turn on and off, I say, wait, they're blueprints, and they're no different in a sense of function to a blueprint in an architect's office. And why I bring that up as being relevant is simply this. You go into an architect's office, she's working on a blueprint, and you look over her shoulder, and you casually say, hey, is your blueprint on or off? And she would look at you like, what, are you crazy? It's a blueprint. There's no on or off. And I go, precisely. Genes are blueprints. They have no on and off. They have no idea what they do, how they do it. They're just a blueprint. We have given them this massive power of making decisions and turning on actions and things like that. It's like completely false. Genes don't turn on and off. And all of a sudden I say, oh, well, then how do things work? I say, well, just like with a blueprint, there's a contractor that reads the blueprint. And all of a sudden I say, oh, then the contractor is not the blueprint. No, the contractor is above the blueprint. I go, oh, well, guess what? The new science is not called genetics now. It's called epigenetics. And the prefix epi is revolutionary because epi means above. So when I say genetic control, I simply say control by genes. So, oh, your life is, you got a cancer gene, you're going to get cancer. That's the belief. Now we talk about epigenetics. I go, what is that? Well, epigenetic control means control above the genes. Ah! First time science has really fully gotten down to the ownership is genes make no decisions in the entire world at all. Whether they're on or off is not up to the gene. The significance is how you as the contractor, what is that contractor that controls the genes? And it turns out it's the nervous system and the mind. And the reason is very simple. The nervous system reads the environment. And as the environment changes and your biology has to adjust to the environment, very simple point, you go outside when it's cold out, and the cold being picked up by the nervous system leads to a change in the chemistry of the blood by the brain that causes the body to warm up. So you raise your metabolism, you heat up. I say, wait, same person walks outside and it's warm out. I go, oh, well, the nervous system picks up that it's warm, changes the chemistry of the blood, which then causes the cells to act in a different way and cool the body down by perspiring. I go, oh, where's the thinking process? Where's the genes that control all this? It's like, it's irrelevant. There's no thinking and there are no genes. It's a reflex. The environment was cold, the body warms up. The environment's warm, body cools down. And so basically, it's, oh, well, then there's an interface of how genes are activated in response to environmental signals. I go, yes. And why is this relevant? Because it's the signals that determine the consequence of the genes. And just to, you know, roughly start off with a very simple point, I mean, we talk about the breast cancer gene, BRCA1, the big breast cancer gene. And it's interesting because they say, oh, yeah, this is the gene that's responsible for breast cancer. And I go, okay, well, you know, answer this question. And the question is this, how come 50% of the women that have the gene don't get the breast cancer? And all of a sudden, why is it a relevant question? The answer is, well, they have the same gene, but they don't get the cancer. And so a woman with the gene gets the cancer, and the woman standing next to her with the same gene doesn't get the cancer. it's not the gene that caused the cancer, because if it was the gene that did it, everybody with a gene would have the cancer. If 50% of the people with a cancer gene don't get cancer, then you cannot tell me that that gene caused cancer. It didn't, because a lot of women have it with no cancer. So all of a sudden you say, then, what is it then? And the answer is this, is that it's a response to the environment through perceptions and beliefs and emotions and attitudes and physically what's going on in the environment as well. And this is what's above the genes, epigenetic. And why is that relevant? Because you're the one that can control your environment, and you're the one that can change your perceptions. These are the epigenetic control mechanisms. So since you can control those, then by definition, you're not a victim. By definition, you're a master. Change the environment. Change the perception. Immediately when you do that, you'll change gene activity. So all of a sudden we go back and say, okay, old story. Genes are self-actualizing units that control life. And I go, no, genes are blueprints. And interesting fact, it's not just the way the blueprint is materially expressed as a physical gene, for this simple reason. How you respond to the world, your perceptions and your beliefs can, through epigenetics above the genes, not just activate a gene, but it can change the expression or readout of that gene. It can make thousands of variations of the same protein building block from the same single gene. All of a sudden it says, oh my God, what does that? I said, it's the way you respond to the world. And all of a sudden it says, well, wait, we have a misunderstanding about genes. I say, basically, number one, you do. Genes have no activity. They're just blueprints. Number two, very important, only 3% of the DNA inside the nucleus of the cell is representing actual genes that make proteins. That means 97% of the DNA didn't make a gene product. And for the longest time, science and then the public started to refer to this as junk DNA. And they go, junk DNA, it's like, oh, that's all this extra DNA that the stupid cell, being stupid, has carried around for a billion years, and, you know, it's like extra luggage, and it doesn't do anything. And now, with the understanding of epigenetics, it is completely different. There is no junk DNA. All the DNA is being used. And you say, well, then what's all the stuff that is, you know, genetic but not making protein, that junk stuff? And it's like, no, those are programs of how to use the building blocks that are made by the genes. So I have about 19,000 genes, and collectively they can make 100,000 different proteins, and the genes are the blueprints for those. But hey, right away you figure, wait, you got 19,000 genes, you got 100,000 different proteins using a gene blueprint. Where did it come from? And the answer is epigenetics can cause a gene to read this way or to read that way. So the same gene can cause multiple things depending on the environment. And so now we recognize that all of a sudden it's not junk DNA. It tells us how to use something. So I'll give you an example. There's a gene that makes a protein called keratin. I said, what does keratin do? Well, keratin is the foundation of the skin cells, that resist the water and makes a protective surface. So yeah, keratin is also built into fingernails. It's built into claws. Keratin is also hair. And you go, wow, the same protein is providing for all these things? I say, well, the gene for keratin just makes keratin. Who determines where and how that keratin is going to be used? Is it going to become hair, or is in another cell going to become a claw? That's the so-called junk DNA. That's how important it is. It's the pattern. That's why a chimp and a human can have the exact same genes, but they don't have the same body or the same abilities. It's not in the genes. It was in the junk DNA. So now we separate the DNA, and we find that there's a DNA that makes blueprints, and there's the DNA that controls blueprints. And 97% is control, 3% is for blueprints. And now you say, okay, wait. So in assembling a body, then what you need to do is you need to activate the genes and then control the readout. Now, activating the genes becomes a problem, and here's where the problem is. The problem is that for almost all of the genes in our body, except on the X and Y chromosome, the other 22 chromosomes in the body, the non-sex chromosomes, the chromosome from the father and the chromosome from the mother are pairs, matching pairs. They both have genes that control the same thing. So I have, let's say, two genes to control a trait. One came from my mother, one came from my father. One on the chromosome that my mother provided, one on the matching chromosome my father provided. So they say, oh, well, I can blend those. And I go, well, here's the interesting story. In the cells, as far as we know, one of the genes of every pair, in most of the genes, and there's most of them, one of the genes is used and the other gene is not used. So let's say, oh, I use the mother's characteristic for this gene, so I'll cancel the gene on the matching one from the father. It's because there are two genes. I'm only going to use one. So therefore, I have to shut off one of the genes. I can't have both of them work at the same time. It doesn't work that way. So I say, well, how do you shut off a gene? I say, well, when you attach a certain chemical group called a methyl group, which is a CH4, it's a very simple organic thing. When you attach methyl groups to the gene blueprint, you change the activity and readout of the blueprint. And there are certain methyl genes, activating genes, when I add it's like a chemical attachment. It's like an enzyme that picks up a methyl group and then binds it to the DNA at certain sites. And where the methyl binds determines whether I can turn the gene on or off. So the first thing methylation does is determine which gene is going to be shut down of the two, the mother's or the father's contribution, and the one that gets methylated is not going to be expressed, and the other one is going to be expressed. And now I say, well, you got 19,000 genes, and most of those are duplicated between the mother and father. You have to do a lot of methylation to shut off certain genes. Well, the activity is then dependent on which gene is going to be read and which one is inhibited. And the significance is one of the genes could be defective, and if read, will create more of a physical problem. And the other gene could be normal, but if not read, you won't see the result. But if I methylate and switch, I can shut off the one and activate the other. So methylation is a dynamic process of putting inhibitors on a DNA so I don't use that one and use the other. But I can change it, and I can change the methylation, shut down the other one and activate the one that was formerly repressed. So methylation is an epigenetic mechanism, and I say, well, okay, what is the mechanism? What are we talking about? I say, well, if a signal is going to alter the biology, then it has to interact with the biology in some way. And epigenetics is a process by which an environmental signal engages an enzyme which then adds or takes off methyl groups. And therefore, an environmental signal is controlling the readout of a gene. Change the perception of that signal, change the signal, and you'll change the methylation process. So all of a sudden it says, wait, I got two genes for everything, and apparently my system is selecting one gene and repressing the other, repressing it by putting a methyl group on it. And I go, I'm doing a selection process, like, you know, one from column A, one from column B, and I'm selecting out of these. And by changing the combinations, I change the final expression of the organism by which genes are active and which genes are canceled with methylation. Now, science has understood this, and just for a little sidebar for a second, I really want to separate science from technology. Science, real science, is just understanding how things work. Technology is to take the story of science and turn it into something useful or not useful, by the way, it turns out a lot, by technology people. So science finds out about the fact that methylation seems to control gene activity, and the pharmaceutical industry is technology. It says, now that we have an understanding of methylation, let's control methylation. And they say, oh, this chemical affects methylation, so take this drug, it'll change your methylation. And I go, good idea, bad idea. And I say, well, good idea, why? Oh, yeah, because methylation is involved. Bad idea, why? And this is the biggest problem about the entire failure of the pharmaceutical industry, is that the pharmaceutical industry depends on the fact that I give you a drug, and that drug goes throughout your body and affects everything everywhere with that drug. And the whole idea is this. The body's intelligence is much greater than that. When it adds a signal to change something, the body doesn't just throw it out and say, hey, everybody out there, change. It sends a signal to the exact cell and the destination where the change is needed. It's very restricted and focused. And I say, well, what's the problem with pharmaceuticals? Well, they don't focus where the activity is. Yeah, you're going to change methylation. Which one are you going to change? Oh, we'll just put the drug in there. It affects methylation. It's like, no, no. Which one are you going to try to change? And I say, here's where the problem comes from. I designed a drug to change this thing, focus here. But I distribute it generally throughout the body. And I go, where's the problem? The problem is, but that same signal does something different somewhere else. And so the same drug that is affecting the positive change I want here, because it's distributed throughout the body, can affect the thing over there. I didn't want to affect that. Oh, we call that side effects. They're not side effects. They're direct effects of putting a drug into the system thinking that you can focus the response. We have to understand it's the human intelligence and the cellular intelligence and the nervous system intelligence that directly manipulates and controls cells by exactly where they are, as compared to pharmaceutical that says, just put it in the body, it will take care of it. And so that's my little sidebar. Be very careful of concepts. They say, oh, well, this is a drug that affects methylation. I say, did it affect it very specifically in the cell that you want to affect it with, or does it affect it in the system? When I put chemotherapy in the body to kill the cancer cells, oh, that was a great intention. What's the side effect? Well, it kills any cell that's dividing, which means your normal health-providing stem cells. Side effect. Direction of chemotherapy, kill cancer, side effect, I kill the rest of your cells. This is not the intention, but that's why I want people to understand, if you start working with the mind can send the messages exactly to where it's needed to do the exact change. Let me give you a simple an example. If you just take this example as a foundational belief and realize how significant it is, it's like this. I hypnotize you. I tell you I'm going to touch you with a burning cigarette. And I take the tip of my finger and I touch you on your arm. Within a minute or two, you'll get a blister and a whelan flare, just like an inflammatory response to a burn. I go, well, wait. I just touched you with my fingertip. There was no physical burn. Nothing happened. But I created an entire blister. Why? The mind perceived very specifically where that burn was supposed to be, saw the burn in its mind. And then even because the local tissue didn't make a response, the mind said, well, oh, there's a communication problem. The brain will just take over and make a blister. Irregardless if the local cells are going, nothing's happened here. The brain will say, oh, there was a blister right there, make it right there. And I say, look, that's how specific it is. The mind just has to have an intention of where the blister is going to go, and boom, it makes the blister specifically where it goes to go. So that's different than a pharmaceutical thing that says, I want to make the blister, I throw this chemical into you, and now your entire body's got blisters all over it. And this is what we have to recognize. So let's go back to methylation, because, again, that's a very important part, and that's only one part of epigenetics, above the genes, information from the environment, selecting which genes are going to be methylated, is really due to an insight, an awareness of the intelligence of the system. And therefore, methylation is activated or inactivated not by trying to deal with the methyl groups. That's the mechanism. You have to identify why you want this mechanism active here and not active over there. Oh, that's above the methyl. That methyl is after that. Above the methyl is, what's the intention? What's the vision? Did I see a blister? Then I'll need to make a change right here. And then all of a sudden this really becomes relevant to the fact that the activation or inhibition of those alternate gene combinations are really based on what is the ultimate picture of the vision of the mind. Because the vision of the mind is going to be translated by the brain into chemistry. And it is that chemistry that is going to be specifically delivered, just like a nerve cell is going to take that message over to here, and it's not going to take it over there. It's going to take it where it's to go. The mind will create a signal that will be delivered directly to the cells that need methylation and change that activity. If you don't like the expression that it is, then change the image that you're looking for, and there's then the opportunity for the signal from the brain to alter the methylation process and rebuild the body to conform to the image. And so let me just, a little insight here, Eva, that I just love. You know, I'm talking a lot. Well, that's me.
I love it. Just keep going.
Let me just give you an image. This is how simple, just to simplify the ultimate simplicity of this body and its mind. And it's referring to back to when we were kids, we most of us did something called paint by numbers. where you got a picture which had all the outlines, and the inside were little numbers, and the numbers reflected a paint, a different color paint. And so what you do is you take your paintbrush, and as I say, you dip in a number 5, which is a red, and then on the outline, there are little spaces where it says 5, and you fill the red in, and when you put all the paints together, you create the final image. The mind is, now this is cool, reverse paint by numbers. It starts with the image, and then breaks it down into the colors. Well, when I'm talking about mind, emotions are like colors. Okay, so it takes the picture in your mind, breaks it down into chemistry, which are the numbers of the different hormones and growth factors and regulators. They're like paints. So you take a picture, you break it down into the subunit colors, paints, and those chemicals then go out to the body to make a complement to the picture. So the idea picture in your head is then translated by the brain into chemistry to use your body as a paint-by-numbers kit and take the numbers from the interpretation and use those not as paints but as chemical regulators from the brain to regulate the body to conform to the image. And therefore, if we have a positive image about our life and where we're going, then the chemistry is going to go out to the body, select all the genes and activities that will create and manifest a physical image. It's a blueprint that makes that physical image. In contrast, if you have a negative image about what you anticipate, what you expect, what you believe is going to happen, the mind will convert that negative image into biology and manifest it as well. And that's the issue. Illness turns out to be less than 1% of illness is controlled by the genes. 99%, 90 to 99% of illness is the picture in your mind that is translated into your biology.
So I have a question.
Yes.
Whenever's an appropriate
time. I'm stopping
place.
Enough to answer the question right now.
Well, I actually have a couple questions.
Let's go with that.
So I'll ask them all, and then you can answer whichever one you want in the order that you want it.
Okay.
The first one is, for children, or anybody for that matter, who can't seem to get control of the mind, can nutrition play a role? And number two, if you are able to work on your mind part, how long does it take for the gene to stop expressing?
Okay. Good questions. Let's start first with the nutrition one, because it's a really interesting one. What my research revealed is that the chemical composition of my culture medium controlled the fate of the cells. And I go, well, culture medium is my synthetic approach to matching the blood from where the cells came from. So if I have mouse cells in a tissue culture, I try to make culture medium that matches the composition of mouse blood. And chicken cells, I don't use mouse medium, I have chicken medium where the blood composition of chicken is different. And so culture medium is a complement or matching to the blood of the body. Well, let me give you the first very important thing about culture medium in a laboratory. I do not buy the elements to make cell culture medium from Kmart. I buy it from the best sources possible. Why? This is the direct nourishment resource for the cells. That's the world they live in. Nutrition then becomes an important element. It's not the total element, because in the end, the mind even controls that. But the fact is this, if you're not paying attention, then at least offer yourselves a better background nutrition, because the healthier the nutrition, the healthier the building blocks of the cells are going to be. It's as simple as that. So is nutrition important? Yes, until you become so conscious that you recognize nutrition wasn't even relevant, because it turns out that we can really get most of the energy we need just from absorbing it from the environment. Just like plants absorb sunlight, humans absorb electromagnetic energy from the environment and can convert that into biological fuel, such as breatharians, for example, who have a much better hold on that process. So basically, is nutrition important? First question, the answer is, especially if you're unaware, the better your nutrition is, at least you're not sabotaging yourself by throwing, garbage in there and expecting something wonderful to happen with it. It's not going to happen. But then it also comes down, and I really need to emphasize this, but we're most 99.999% of the people in the spine are not there, but I want to tell you how a very important insight. So, again, I'll give you the story, and then the insight makes it important, and that is down South Road, their fundamentalists work themselves up into religious ecstasy. Some of them play with poisonous snakes, serpent handlers, to testify that God protects them, but the real extreme ones, and this is what I'm trying to get to you at, the ones that so believe that God protects them, they drink strychnine poison in toxic doses. And with that belief and testifying, they actually have no harmful effects from drinking strychnine poison. I say, why is that relevant? And the answer is, well, if you believe just because you put something in your body that's going to affect you, the answer is no, because it's based on your belief system what comes into the body. That strychnine poison did not come into their bodies. Why? Their belief system had a complete adamant, I will not use this strychnine poison. And guess what? They drink this toxic stuff and they don't get sick. And then people think, well, don't eat that much sugar. They're thinking, you think sugar's a problem? Try drinking strychnine and see if that's a problem. And the issue is, yeah, both sugar and strychnine, their effectiveness is really related to the mind. But we don't have, as I said, that mindset that those people have that testify, because they're completely into that belief that God is protecting them. So there's no doubt in their belief system. Myself, even with all the knowledge I have enough doubt not to drink the strychnine at this point, even though I know I could get away with it if my mind were right, but I'm not there, and most people are not. So then until you become there, when you get there, then does it make a difference what you eat? And the answer is no, absolutely not. But we're not there. So until we get there, then nutrition is a wonderful support mechanism to at least keep you from more undermining yourself than if you ate junk food. Okay, so now that was question one. Question two was which one now?
Was if you do have, you kind of got it all. I'll ask about the people who didn't have mind, and then the people who did have mind, how long would it take
to make it happen?
Yes.
Okay. The answer is that's a variable depending on if the environmental influence is supporting that. I'll give you an example that most people talk about making a habit like 21 days. And they come up with that number, but that's true, because if you follow the same repetitive pattern for 21 days, by the end of 21 days, the subconscious mind has been repetitively programmed with the same thing over and over and over again. It will learn it. Does it have to take 21 days? The answer is not necessarily. You could have some incident in your life that's such a shock to your survival or to your belief system and blows your mind big time, one experience, and you'll never do that again. And so basically, how long did it take to learn that? One experience. But something like driving a car, no, I think you're going to have to take a number of lessons to get there. But something that shocks the hell out of you in your life is a total threat. You did it once, you've learned that. So how long does it take to change? And the answer is, well, depending on the shock value of it. I recently changed a diet going from conventional diet into called a keto diet, ketosis diet, which is eliminating carbohydrates. And actually, what's very interesting is to transition from my regular diet to the ketosis diet means to retool my metabolism, change the chemistry and activity of my digestive system. And it takes, in doing it, it took about a week before my body could adjust to the new diet. So there are time periods. There's a physical expression of activities that have to be, you know, there's a thought that's instantaneous, but then there's convert the thought into the physical realm. That takes time period. And the time period is a variable based on what you're trying to change and the process that leads you to that change. So I can't say there's any specific thing in regard to, oh, if you're going to do that, oh, that's the 21-day one. Oh, no, if you're going to do this, this is the 7-day one. I can't say that. And each person is different, so it'd be very hard, and that's what irritates a lot of people, because then you say, oh, it should take 7 days to do that, and somebody is like now into 10 days, 11 days, and they're going, oh, my God, you know, it's not working for me. And the fact is, well, there are no two people the same. So if the average is 7 days, there's going to be some people that are going to take 2 weeks, and there are going to be some people that are doing it in 3 days. And so we have to recognize if we try to set a time issue, in some sense that also becomes a little negative, because if it doesn't work out according to that time, people feel, oh, you know, it's not working. or something and then give up, and that's really an unfortunate situation.
Okay, here's another question. And when I listen to you, sometimes I have to struggle because I want to get off on consciousness, you know, because I realize that that's what it really is, but I have to keep coming back to the people that listen to my show.
And I want to go there with you.
Well, I'm not there yet, but this particular gene, if you, let's say you have a plus-plus gene from both parents. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Let's just say you have MTHFR gene and you have plus-plus. So you were talking about earlier methylation. When one's methylating, then it doesn't express. And if it's not methylating, then it will express. So
that's
what
general,
happens when you have two positive...
That's a general statement, Eva, because there are some methylations, very few that we know, that actually activate something. Well, most methylations, when present, are inhibiting. I don't want to say that's 100% because I know that there are some methylation processes that actually activate a gene. So we have to keep open to that.
Well, when you have two genes from both parents,
yes,
and it's a bat, it's one that you don't want.
Yes.
How do you get it not to express? Other than the obvious, the mind, we got that.
Okay. Now, so I said that the one process of epigenetics is methylation, which is, you know, selecting which genes are going to be active and which ones are not going to be active. Okay. The second process, which is a bigger part of epigenetics, is not affecting the DNA straight. It's affecting the readout of the DNA. So remember, DNA is a blueprint, okay? And so it's a linear blueprint like in the old days. I don't know if anybody remembers, but they used to have stock ticker tapes where the stock things would come out on a long ribbon, you know, just like a ribbon of letters, okay?
Mm-hmm.
A gene is like one of those. It's a ticker tape with a sequence of letters in it. And the other act of epigenetics is on regulation of the blueprint. Now you say, well, what do you mean regulation of the blueprint? I go, in that junk DNA, there are some genes that engage activities that cause cutting and pasting of the blueprint. In my lecture, just because that's the one in my head right now, I say, imagine a gene, a linear gene, as a word reading, R-E-A-D-I-N-G. That's the message. That's the blueprint. I say, okay, I make the gene, and it says reading. I go, yeah, but by adjusting the other epigenetic mechanisms of regulation, it's cutting and pasting. Instead of reading, if I cut off the ing, now the gene is read. It's not reading anymore. If I cut off the rea, then reading becomes ding. If I, you know, cut out some of the letters, I can end up with an ad in the middle and add. And what I'm saying is, every time I cut and paste the letters, I change the word. The word is a different version of the protein. What's the relevance of epigenetics part two, not methylation, but regulation, is that is the system that takes the blueprint copy from the DNA and then has the ability to cut and paste it together in different sequences. So I have the blueprint, same blueprint, but by cutting and pasting it, I can change the reading. I cut off a snip off a piece, and then it reads something different, or add a piece, and it changes the reading again. And why is that relevant? Because every time I alter the gene blueprint, I alter the protein. And I say, why is it relevant? Because if there's a negative protein, I can turn it around by reading the environment differently and cause one of the variations. Remember, I said you can make 3,000 or so variations from each gene. Well, I can have a gene, and one of the variations, I can have a healthy gene, make a variation that will actually cause a mutant expression, then cause a disease. Cancer is primarily that. Most people have healthy genes. It's the epigenetic alteration of the reading that takes the healthy gene that causes a mutant protein, and cancer comes from taking a healthy gene and in a certain lifestyle, causing it to become mutated. Well, an exact same thing works in reverse. If I have a mutant gene and I make variations on the copying of that mutant gene, I can manifest a different version that actually is healthy. So all of a sudden, and this is in my book, one of the illustrations, there's a mouse called an agouti mouse, which is a dominant gene for a negative trait, which is obesity and cardiovascular disease and a change in fur color, which is evident to see it. Why is it relevant? Because I show two pictures of mice, the mutant big fat one mouse, and right next to it a normal-looking mouse, and then as the caption says, both of them are genetically identical, but they were raised in different environments. The mother, the genetically identical eggs were planted into mother A and to mother B. Mother A in one environment, mother B in another environment. And guess what? In mother A, the agouti mutant showed up, and the mouse was, you know, fat and sick and had different color fur. And I say, the same genetically identical egg put in mother B, but in a different supportive environment, is normal. And I say, well, what do you mean normal? I say, it has the gene for the mutation, but the mouse does not have any of those effects of the mutation, the fur color, the obesity, all those other things. Why? Epigenetic change, the reading of the gene. It's called somatic mutations. Mutations occur in the cells to make the cell fit the need of the environment. And as I change my belief system, I can rewrite my genetics. I didn't change the genes. Same genes. What I changed was epigenetic regulation, not epigenetic methylation. That's the one that just says which genes are going to be active or not. Epigenetic regulation is the one with the scissors and the paste that says, let me take that blueprint and splice it together in a different way, and I can change the meaning of it. And that is a major, major part of epigenetics. That's why you can have the same two twins, a pair of twins, are born, let's say they're identical twins, so they're born with essentially the same genetic readout. But then you look at the genetic activity of these twins a year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the road. When you did it when they were first born, their genetic patterns were almost exactly the same. But as a year goes by, 5, 10, 20 years, the genetic expression between the two siblings starts to become quite variable. They're no longer the same. One could end up with cancer and the other could be normal. It's like, wait, they started with the same genes. And now we know when you look at the genetic readout, every year of life, every year of experience on the planet, every year of belief issues leads to a rewriting of the genetic code so that once identical twins with identical readouts, as they grow up, can end up with very different readouts. One becoming healthy, one dying of disease, and yet both have the same genes.
Okay, I wasn't going to do this, but I'm going to do it. I wasn't going to go into consciousness because I always do that, but I can't help it. We have 15 minutes, so I'm going to give you two questions. The first, because as much as I wanted to ask questions about supplements, that's just not where the answer is, you know?
No, the answer really is... I agree with you, Eva, and that's really important because I can talk about supplements and I can say, well, what's the consciousness of the person taking it? And I say, why is that relevant? Because I say, if they already have a consciousness that perceives of their life as being sickly and they have a negative life experience and all that kind of stuff like that, and there's a person next to them with very positive wishes and hopes and desires, and so we have two patients with the same disease, and I give one the supplements, and they, the one that has a very positive thing, is like all of a sudden they got healthier and happier and all that stuff. I go, that's great. And I say, the other one, I give them the same supplements, but they don't have an image of healing. They don't see that in their future. I go, guess what? You just wasted all the supplements. They're not using it because the image in their mind is what they're building, not the image in, like their mind is. If you can take the mind out of the body, then the body will maintain itself. Very interesting point. When a person's in coma and you read their physiology while they're on the gurney and they're just laying there, they have a wonderful physiology, heart rhythm, rate, pumping, blood pressure, the machine is running like on idling. It's beautiful. If they become conscious all of a sudden, as soon as the mind comes back in, all of those numbers are thrown out again.
Well, that's amazing. I never thought about that.
When the mind wasn't in, the body will self-regulate. When the mind is in, the body is designed to conform to the mind. Therefore, I say, so we can have a discussion about supplements, but it all then comes down to, so now tell me about the consciousness of the person taking the supplement, because that will determine the actual reality.
All right. We have 14 minutes.
Let's go.
Two questions. One of them, I think we should probably, maybe you can give the people some instruction here about, because we've got 10 minutes, about what they can do when they hang up the phone to try move towards mind. So, number one, how do they first become aware that those very, very, very subconscious thoughts are not benefiting them? Because, you know, you think people, remember, there's two questions, so let me get the other one out. Remember, people walk around and they think they're fine. How do they figure out that they're not fine? Number two is, once they figure that out, what do they do?
Both questions are connected, and they're connected in this regard.
So the next one is, I've got to give you the second question, though. The second question is, once they figure out what it is that they're doing that's not serving them, that's subconscious, what do they do? How do they start? What is the first step that they do to stop that?
Okay. First question A, how do I know I have a problem? Even though my conscious mind says I don't have a problem with this, how do I know I have a problem? The answer is straightforward and simple. Number one, as we talked about in an earlier program, our programming occurs between the last trimester of pregnancy and the first 7 years. That's when the brain is in a state of theta predominantly, and theta is hypnosis, and we download behavior to run our lives by observing other people. So the fundamental behaviors in our subconscious program are actually not our behaviors. They came from other people. Our conscious mind, being creative, has all the wishes and desires of what we want. And then I said, well, how do you know if you have programs that support you? And now, because we also know this, the subconscious is operating 95% of the time and controlling your life. Therefore, the beliefs in your subconscious, which you may not have any conscious awareness of, simply I say, well, what did you learn when you were 1 year old? What did you learn when you were 5 months old? It's like, you have no consciousness of that, so you can't answer the question. So the idea is, you can't really tell me what your programs are, because most of them you got before you even were aware you were being programmed. So I say, well, then how the hell do I know what my programs are? And then I go, because 95% of your life comes from those subconscious programs. So the first thing you have to do is just look at your life and say, everything that comes easy that I want, I have because I have programs that encourage that to be there. In contrast, and this is the one we got to wake up to, anything that I try to obtain, to get to create, to realize, that I have trouble in doing it, where I have to work hard, I have to sweat, I have to put a lot of effort into it. The first question is, why are you working so hard? The answer almost inevitably is that what you're trying to change is representing a program in your subconscious that's not supporting you, and you're trying to consciously change it. And I go, oh, well, there's your problem. 95% is going to come from that program, and conscious mind is not going to change that. And so the idea is, how do you know what your programs are? What, you know, even if your head is saying, I have no problems in my life, well, except for the fact that I can't do this or that, and then we're thinking, oh, that's the outside that's preventing me from getting there, and I'm going to say, no, it's not the outside that is making a resistance to your destination. It's almost inevitably an inside program. So you're just reflecting where you're competing against a program, where your conscious mind wants to go this way and your program is taking you that way. Then just look at your life and say, where are the places the program's not taking me to that I want to go? And I'm going to say right away, that's basically where you're going to start to look for the programming in the subconscious, because it's inevitably you're following a path of subconscious programming. And anything that you find troublesome in that pathway, we have had a tendency to say, oh, it's the universe is not providing that. And now we're really seeing a whole different story. Universe will provide anything. It's your own subconscious program that is limiting you. So all of a sudden it says, great, I don't have to do a lot of psychoanalysis. And I go, absolutely not. Your life is a printout. Just look at your life. That's the analysis. And so now you say, well, oh, my God, I have these behaviors that are sabotaging me. I don't see them. And that's because the insidious part is it comes from the subconscious, and these behaviors only play when the conscious mind's not paying attention. And then I say, unfortunately, that's 95% of the time, because when the moment the conscious mind is thinking, then by definition it's not paying attention. What are you doing next Thursday at 4 p.m.? And all of a sudden your conscious mind has to go inside its head, go find the calendar, look for what's going on inside your head while you're processing this data. And I go, and yes, and while you're processing that data in your head, are you paying attention to what's going on around you? And the answer is no. Why? The conscious mind is focused. and therefore the behavior that's going on around you is coming from the subconscious, but you can't see it, and that becomes the biggest problem, because we have great conscious wishes and desires, and while we're thinking about our wishes and desires, we are inevitably sabotaging ourselves with invisible programs, because they're invisible, because when they're playing, they're playing because we're not paying attention. So now you say, well, how do I get to pay attention to it? I say, sometimes it accidentally, you just say, oh, my God, I was just acting like my mother, or my, I was just doing my father. Oh, my God, it was almost embarrassing when you think about it. Well, then occasionally you see all of a sudden that invisible programming just became visible for a moment. But the idea is this, other people see it all the time. Because just because you're playing that program and your mind's busy and you don't see it, everybody else sees it. So if you're in a relationship or you're in a community and you're with people you trust, they're your best mirror, because they're the ones that are going to say, you know, you didn't, maybe you didn't hear what you were just saying. You were probably saying, oh, that'll never happen. And it's like that's an automatic response from subconscious. But what you're not listening to is that will never happen. That's a future program. You're canceling something before you even got there. But another person listening can hear that. So the best reflection is being in a community where everyone knows that we're playing these programs. It's not our intention to do that. It's not even who we are when we do that. If everyone is aware of that and some stupid, lousy behavior shows up, rather than getting people all upset, people are recognizing and say, oh, you know, that behavior you just played, that's not really supporting you. That's the best feedback of all. So the two feedbacks you have is look at your life, what's not working, almost inevitably is a representation of a program. And when you have people around you that you can communicate with safely, they will, every time they bring it up, it's creating a habit. So you want to change a program, then you have to recognize this. Changing the conscious mind was simple. That's a creative mind. Read the self-help book, listen to our conversation, go to a lecture. Boom, conscious mind picks that up because it's creative. That's how it learns. But your programs are coming from the subconscious. It does not learn that way. So you can pick up the self-help book. You can read it. Educate the conscious mind. How do I know it's educated? I'll give you a quiz. You'll get 100. And I'll say, yep, you knew the content of the book. But then you look at your life and you go, well, I read the content of the book, but the life is still the same. And I go, yeah, because you educated the conscious mind by reading the book. But that is not a process by which the subconscious learns. So, great. If you could stay mindful, then you would be operating from the principles of the self-help book. But we're only 5% mindful, so 95% of the time, you're operating subconscious who didn't learn a damn thing from reading that book, because that's not how it learns. How does it learn? Four fundamental ways. Let me give it to you. First fundamental way is hypnosis. That's how you learn the first 7 years, how you got the basic programming because your mind was in theta and downloading directly the stuff right into the subconscious. You can use subliminal tapes because every night as you go to bed, your mind passes through theta just as you're going to sleep. So if you have a new program playing with earphones on as you're going to bed, as you're just going unconscious, your brain is in theta, hypnosis. Guess what it's going to do? Download that program that's on the tape unconsciously. So you're not even aware you got the program going in. So that's why subliminal tapes work. So the first 7 years, hypnosis. I say, yeah, but after 7, you're not in hypnosis. How does the subconscious learn? I go, ah. Repetition. How'd you learn anything? Practice. Repeat it until what? It becomes a habit. How many times did you say ABC till you could get the Z all the way without making a mistake? Tell me how many times you repeated that. Lots of times, over and over. Every time you got to the stopping point, you know, okay, you got to learn that next letter, and then repeat it, and then get past that to another letter. And what happens? Today, you don't have to repeat the alphabet. It's completely in your head. You can rattle off for me unconsciously, push the button, play the tape. How'd you get that? Habit. Oh, okay. You want to change something? Then you have to manifest a habit and do it as an exercise and repeat it. Why? That's how you learn, repetition. So the two fundamental ways, natural learning, A, hypnosis, first 7 years, and new subconscious programs after 7 are primarily a result of repetitive experience, doing it over and over and over again, practicing. Now I'm going to give you the...
Yeah, 3 minutes.
Okay, and number one, you can't do anything about, but I got to tell you about it. Sometimes a shock in life can cause the subconscious to change the program instantaneously. Sometimes, like you go, if a person goes to the doctor and all of a sudden they got terminal cancer diagnosis, at that moment you can... shock your system and boom, change your life and do something different right there. That's possible, but it's not controllable. But the one you can control and is possible and is the fastest is a whole group of new modalities, which you're aware of and the show has talked about. It's these new things called energy psychology or belief change modification techniques, which are processes that enhance super learning. And in the super learning process, you can download new data and engage the subconscious in minutes. All of these are the ways to change the subconscious. The worst possible way of approaching it, and the one that most people use and doesn't work but makes them more frustrated, is talking to yourself. Okay, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. And I'm thinking, well, first of all, who are you talking to? You say, well, I'm going to talk to the subconscious not to do that. And then I go, well, here's an interesting fact. There is an entity in the conscious mind. That's you. That's the seed of your personal identity. The subconscious mind is a machine. There's nobody in there. Frustration? Yeah, keep talking to the machine and expect it to change. There's nobody listening. That's not how it does it. So when we get frustrated by repeating, oh, my God, I keep doing the same stupid mistake. Now I'm mad at myself, and I'm getting angry, and I'm saying, this frustration is going to take you farther away from change forever, because the subconscious mind is like a precocious five-year-old in a sense. You want to help a five-year-old? Then don't yell at it. It will actually be refractive to anything. Yelling, they'll just go in a shell. You want to change a child's behavior, then you give it loving attention and loving support and help it change in a very loving way. You want to change yourself, then don't get mad at yourself because that will cause resistance. Encourage yourself for a very simple reason. If you catch yourself doing something that you keep saying, I don't want to do, that was the most important point. You caught yourself. Why? It's a moment to make a new pattern. Oh, I caught myself. Okay, stop it. Don't do this again. When it shows up the next time you catch it, oh, wait, moment of change. Stop it. Don't do it again. Do another behavior. What's the point? It's a short number of repetitions when that behavior comes up and you're nice to yourself instead of getting mad when it comes up and saying, oh, thank you for getting my attention. I appreciate that. Now I can stop it. And now I can do this behavior. Repetition. Ah, that's how you train the subconscious. So after you do this a number of times, guess what? The subconscious won't go off on that negative thought before it goes, because it will recognize the moment I go off on that track, you send me on a new track. It will go to the new track. You've changed the program. And you encourage your subconscious by acknowledging, hey, thanks for bringing my attention to it. I didn't eat the entire donut this time before I woke up that I was eating the donut. Now I can put it down. I have a choice. And when you make
that
choice,
you're so fabulous.
That's it. So I know the time was short, Eva. Did I get anything out?
Oh, man, you're so fabulous. Thank you. Thank you for giving me time. Thank you so much. I mean, you're just so fabulous, and I appreciate it. I really do. I know you're, like, so busy, and I'm grateful for you.
Oh, I am very grateful, because as I suggest sometimes, it's a lot easier for me to talk through you, to talk to all those people, than to go to their house and talk to them directly. So you are helping me, and together we're really helping the world find a new program and a better way to live, and that's evolution.
Thank you. Go with Godspeed, Dr. Bruce Lipton, and thank you,
thank
and come
you,
back
Eva.
Sometime.
I would
have
love
a good
to.
One.
Thank you.